Hey there, a quick favor. We are conducting an audience survey, and we'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes and answer some questions in the survey. Please visit survey.prx.org/world to take the survey today. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. And thank you.
After a long pandemic hiatus, Taiwan is throwing the doors open for tourists.
This morning, I wake up, I feel the air is fresh. Finally, we see a light in the end of the tunnel.
I'm Carol Hills, and there are cholera outbreaks around the world right now. That's in line with expectations of more new and re-emerging diseases.
I think this is closer to the new normal, especially in conflict areas where we see infrastructure crumble.
Also today, fall in Kyrgyzstan means walnut harvesting season. Shake a tree and a whole harvest rains down. People collecting those walnuts hope a new app will keep them coming. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're listening to The World. Thanks for joining us on this Friday. Now, only 6 weeks into the job, Britain's prime minister finds herself fighting for her political survival heading into this weekend. Markets in the UK have been in turmoil since Liz Truss announced the government's first budget plan a few weeks ago. And today, Truss fired her finance minister, Kwasi Kwarteng, one of the most senior figures in government. She's hoping that will calm the markets and ease public anger. Our Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, has been following all this. Orla, how big of a surprise was this?
Well, we knew Liz Truss was going to have to do something drastic to quell not only public anger, but frustration among her own party MPs. The expectation over the last few days was that she would do a U-turn on some of the budget plans that her government announced 3 weeks ago. We didn't know she was going to sack her own chancellor like this. And by the way, it looks like he was very much caught off guard as well. He was in Washington this morning and over the last couple of days at an IMF meeting with global finance ministers. Then we knew something was up because she announced she was holding a televised press conference this afternoon. But she said her finance minister, her own chancellor, would not be in attendance. And that press conference was due to be about the economy. So that was a hint to us of what was to come.
Now, Liz Truss came into office promising to grow the UK economy. And she worked closely with the chancellor, Kwasi Kwarteng. So why would she fire him when these were her own policies?
I mean, this is the question everyone is asking today. You're right. These were her ideas when she was running for party leadership during the summer. Her platform was a low tax platform. And when she held a press conference this afternoon, she said that he had decided he was stepping down and new chancellor was taking over. But this conference, which, by the way, was only 7 minutes, almost 8 minutes long, someone said it was the shortest ever press conference that a British prime minister has held. And she only took four questions. Three of those questions were asking her, well, why should you stay if Kwasi Kwarteng has to go? This is the Sun newspaper's Harry Cole.
You and the chancellor, the ex-chancellor, designed this budget together, in lockstep, we're told. He has to go because of the fallout from it. How come you get to stay?
Well, my priority is making sure we deliver the economic stability that our country needs. That's why I had to take the difficult decisions I've taken today.
So how is this all going down within Liz Truss's party, the Conservatives? I mean, it wasn't very long ago that they brought in Liz Truss after losing confidence in Boris Johnson.
Yeah, not well. Tory MPs have been quoted this afternoon as saying Liz Truss's speech has actually made things worse. There's a Conservative Party WhatsApp group among Conservative lawmakers, and some of the texts from that group were leaked by the lawmakers, obviously themselves, this afternoon of their reactions during the press conference. And one MP is quoted as saying, this is really bad. Another, I'm in agony listening to this. We need to get Rishi Sunak in place. The other point to be made is that ever since she became Prime Minister, and particularly following the budget announcements, the polls for the Conservative Party have been really, really terrible. Labour have been leading in the polls by 20 and in some cases 30 points. There is a poll out this morning that shows that Liz Truss's own popularity rating among the British public is actually lower than Boris Johnson's or Jeremy Corbyn's were at their very lowest point. So if today's polls were, you know, tomorrow's election results, less than a third of Conservative MPs would hang on to their seats. And that's what most of them are worried about.
Now, I know Liz Truss has appointed a new finance minister. Jeremy Hunt is taking over. What sort of signal does that send?
It's an interesting choice. I mean, he's a veteran politician, but he actually ran in the leadership race against Liz Truss, but he was knocked out early, and he publicly supported Rishi Sunak to be prime minister. So some are saying that this could be a sign that Liz Truss is actually trying to reach across the political divide in her party and trying to unite forces, because Truss's cabinet has been pretty much full of Liz Truss loyalists. But then again, hearing some comments from Tory lawmakers today, just putting Jeremy Hunt into the job won't satisfy those MPs. Their mood this week has been described as murderous despair, was how one Tory MP put it. And many of them won't be happy until Liz Truss steps down.
Orla Berry is our Europe correspondent. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Carl.
Taiwan has stayed relatively closed throughout the pandemic. It stopped giving out most kinds of visas and enforced strict quarantine rules. Just yesterday, Taiwan finally reopened for tourism. The number of travelers is still capped, and arrivals are advised to stay in their hotel or test themselves during their first week in the country. Ashish Valentine reports from Taipei.
Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen visited Taoyuan International Airport yesterday to thank staff for keeping the country safe and to announce the reopening. I want to tell our friends overseas that Taiwan is ready, she says. You're welcome to come. Welcome to Taiwan. Edward Rada is an American visitor who arrived in Taiwan last night.
I bought this ticket 3 months ago, and who knew that the day I land would be the day that they stopped the quarantine. Hallelujah.
He has close business and personal connections here. So since the borders closed, Rada was practically counting the days until he could come back.
I'm thrilled. I've not been able to be here. It's been 3 years since I was able to visit last. So I'm very happy to be back.
Keeping Taiwan's borders closed was a key part of its COVID strategy. And for a long time, it worked. In fact, for about 200 days in the summer and fall of 2020, as infections skyrocketed in places like the US, Taiwan didn't log a single case. Even going into 2021 and early 2022, despite a few surges, case and death rates were relatively low. Fast forward to earlier this year, however, and the highly infectious Omicron variants entered Taiwan. Jason Wong is a professor of pediatrics and health policy at Stanford University. He says these variants were so infectious, they eventually made contact tracing impossible.
And so they have to switch basically to a concept of, you know, living with the virus.
Almost 9 out of every 10 Taiwanese people is fully vaccinated. And with domestic spread accounting for more cases than imported ones, Wong says keeping the border closed wasn't necessary anymore. Michael Wu runs a private tour company called My Taiwan Tour. Before the pandemic, Wu's company received thousands of international tourists. He even gave tours to celebrities like Ryan Reynolds. Then, in March 2020, Taiwan closed its borders.
No revenue, no one night, you just drop out everything.
The same thing happened to Lin Ruorong, who manages the Star Hostel in Taipei.
We were so busy on dealing with all the cancellation at the time.
Lin says the hostel lost 70 to 80% of its revenue over the pandemic. She had to come up with new ways of making money by catering to the domestic market.
So we thought about maybe we can do monthly rental. We started the co-working space.
Wu did the same. He started a side business creating local, personalized experiences for Taiwanese people. But neither of their businesses was able to make as much money as before. For example, in May 2021, due to a COVID surge, Taiwanese people also stopped traveling for a while.
We have to drop everything again on the same month, which we lost millions of Taiwanese dollars again. It's crazy, yeah.
That's why, when Taiwan announced it was reopening.
This morning, I wake up, I feel the air is fresh. We have a lot of inquiries. Finally, we see a light in the end of tunnel.
Some challenges still remain, both Wu and Lin say it'll be a long time before business picks up back to pre-2020 levels. But for many, both in Taiwan and abroad, it's long-awaited good news. For the world, this is Ashish Valentine in Taipei.
Where there is instability in this world, cholera often follows. The ancient disease is back in the headlines as outbreaks spread in Afghanistan, Democratic Republic of Congo, Ethiopia, and Haiti. And officials are warning an outbreak may be imminent in parts of Ukraine. To discuss the latest global picture, I'm joined by Danielle Lantaine, who's a professor of environmental health at Tufts University. Danielle, remind us how cholera spreads and how dangerous it is.
Cholera is a bacteria, and the Vibrio cholera bacteria spreads when contaminated feces from a human contaminates water or food that is then ingested by another human. Infection can lead to diarrhea that leads to dehydration and then death from the dehydration. It is treatable with rehydration salts or intravenous solutions, but that would need to be in a healthcare facility that can treat the disease.
There are some indications that cholera has infected the drinking water in Mariupol, a city that's been heavily bombed in the Ukraine conflict. So the circumstances, those kind of wartime circumstances, that tracks with the type of places where outbreaks are usually seen?
We have cholera outbreaks worldwide where there is insufficient water and sanitation infrastructure. And we are especially seeing cholera outbreaks return in areas and countries where there was water and sanitation infrastructure. And in conflict, we see those basics of infrastructure break down. We see operation and maintenance not being able to happen. We see chlorine supplies interrupted. And then we see water going out in previously safe infrastructure systems that might contain the cholera bacteria.
There are cholera vaccines, and the company that manufactures one of the only two cholera vaccines will stop production at the end of the year. WHO officials are trying to appeal this decision, but they haven't been successful. What do you think the impact of that will be?
Those vaccines are not as effective as we would hope they are. They are about 60 to 80% effective at preventing contracting cholera for about 2 or 3 years. The World Health Organization has a cholera vaccine stockpile that is distributed when an outbreak happens, and they're an important tool to both prevent outbreaks and to contain outbreaks once they've started. This one company that is ceasing production provides about 15% of the vaccine, and I cannot speak to why they have decided to stop that production. But I can say that the reason World Health is asking them to keep producing is to keep that stockpile of vaccines as high as we can, because when an explosive outbreak happens, like in Haiti, like in Yemen, it goes quickly, and we need those vaccines rapidly.
Maybe it's just me, but I feel like there are a lot of outbreaks right now. I mean, there's COVID, monkeypox, polio, cholera. Is that because we're getting better at monitoring disease, or is the situation on the ground getting worse?
Unfortunately, it is very much the second. There are a number of reasons that we have both new emerging infectious diseases like COVID-19 and that we have reemergence of older diseases like cholera. And those reasons have to do with increased human population, density of human population, movement and transport of humans via plane across the world, the impacts of climate change. Well, it feels like a lot right now to people, and I totally understand that. I think this is closer to the new normal, and we should expect more reemergence and emergence of disease, especially in conflict areas where we see infrastructure crumble.
Danielle Lantaine is a professor of environmental health at Tufts University in Massachusetts. She sits on the Global Task Force for Cholera Control at the World Health Organization. Thanks a lot, Danielle.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. In the Spanish region of Catalonia, a longtime coalition of separatist parties has broken up. Catalonia has its own regional government, which for years has pushed to separate from Spain. It's been one of the biggest territorial disputes in Europe. Alain Ruiz Terol reports on why this breakup of parties may be the end of an era for Catalonia's independence movement.
This Tuesday, in Barcelona, new cabinet members took the oath of office from the head of the Catalan government, President Pere Aragonès.
Prometeu complir fidelment les obligacions del càrrec al servei de Catalunya i amb lleialtat al president de la Generalitat de Catalunya?
Sí, prometo.
One by one, seven new ministers promised to serve Catalonia and be loyal to President Aragonès. They replaced the departing members of the Junts per Catalunya party, the junior partner in the pro-independence coalition, who called it quits last Friday. Laura Borràs is the head of Junts per Catalunya.
Els nostres afiliats han decidit que cal sortir del govern de la Generalitat, però recordem perquè això és així.
Party members have decided that we must leave the Catalan government, she said. And the reason was that Aragonès and his party, Esquerra, were not delivering on their coalition agreement, particularly on the common goal of independence. Over the past decade, the grassroots independence movement gave rise to the complicated alliance between the two parties, who needed each other to stay in power, but compete constantly for separatist voters. Journalist Joan Serra documented this power struggle in a recent book, An Amics Íntims, roughly translated as Frenemies.
Quan es trenca això, jo crec que es dona per liquidada una etapa.
This breakup puts an end to a phase we all knew was already behind us, he says. The turning point came 5 years ago, on October the 1st, 2017. That day, Catalonia held a referendum on independence, which Spain deemed illegal and tried to stop. Hundreds of voters were injured as riot police shut down polling stations, firing rubber bullets. Despite this, more than 2 million people voted for independence, although most of those who were against stayed at home. Weeks later, after a failed declaration of independence, Spain removed separatist parties from power and imposed direct rule. Pro-independence leaders were either imprisoned or fled to exile. In hindsight, the referendum brought unprecedented international attention to the struggle of Catalan independence, but it came at a great cost and fell short of its ultimate goal. Joan Serra says separatist parties agreed neither on what to make of it nor on the way forward.
Som on som i el trencament del govern es produeix perquè el pecat original és que hi ha un diagnòstic diferent de l'1 d'octubre.
This is the original sin that explains why they broke up, he says. One side sees the referendum as final and wants to seek independence unilaterally. Catalan president Aragonès, on the other hand, still believes dialogue with Spain is the only way forward.
Però nosaltres negociem amb el govern de l'Estat, doncs és reticent el seu parer. Doncs cal seguir sumant amplíssimes majories.
Spain has its own way of seeing things, he says, but we must build wider majorities, gain international support, and learn our lessons from the 2017 vote. In reaction to the breakup of the government in Catalonia, Spain's Prime Minister, Pedro Sánchez, insisted on the need for stability.
Como presidente del gobierno, lo único que puedo decir es que sea cual sea la circunstancia, la coyuntura del gobierno de la Generalitat de Cataluña, nosotros vamos a tener siempre.
He said he remains committed to dialogue. And however difficult, this may be the only way forward for Sánchez too, since his left-wing government relies on the votes of pro-independence parties. With the general election next year, the fates of the governments in Catalonia and Spain are intertwined. For The World, I'm Alan Ruiz Terol.
Iraq has taken a step toward ending more than a year of political gridlock. On Thursday, a new president was elected, and he designated a new prime minister. They now have 1 month to put together a government. Baghdad has seen months of unrest and deadly clashes in the streets, so there's a lot at stake for Iraqis. For more on this, we're joined by Hamza Haddad. He's a visiting fellow with the European Council on Foreign Relations, and he's usually based in Baghdad. Hamza, Iraq now has a new president and prime minister designate. Who are they, and what do they bring to these jobs?
So both the president and the prime minister designate are former ministers in previous governments. So they're not new faces to Iraqis. That might come as a surprise to some who have seen public protests in Iraq in the past 3 years calling for change, calling for new faces. But what we're seeing today is, after a year of stalemate, that Iraq's political elite have come to an agreement and have chosen people that they know quite well.
Now, what does this effectively mean, these changes? Say, for example, with a new president's prime minister designate, is it guaranteed that he will become prime minister?
As you mentioned before, we had elections over a year ago, and we weren't able to move the process forward. And so it's seen that there has been a complete political agreement in order to elect this president. He will designate this prime minister, who should have a shoo-in to get his government passed by parliament.
Now, Iraq was rocked by violence between rival political factions in recent months, and they were pitting Iraqi cleric Muqtada al-Sadr's movement against Iran-backed groups. What's the reaction from Muqtada al-Sadr's movement in response to this nomination?
Mohammed al-Sudani, he was announced to be the nomination before a president was elected. This was back in August when we began to see Sadr's protest overtake the parliament and, you know, violence reached its height in late August. But yesterday's official appointment to designate him to form a government, there were rocket attacks in the direction of the parliament building, but they didn't hit. And it still hasn't, to my knowledge, hasn't been announced who the perpetrators were. But for the most part, it's been a lot more quiet than in August.
Just to clarify, is Mohammed al-Sudani's designation seen as a victory for Iran-backed groups in Iraq?
So some have tried to portray Sudani as being affiliated with Iran. And that may be the case. He might have good relations, but I still don't believe that's enough to judge him as a person, as a prime minister that he may be able to be. So I think it's important for people to judge based on action rather than reputation.
What's been the response from activists and leaders of Iraq's anti-corruption protest movement so far?
So there have been some smaller demonstrations around Iraq that have rejected President Abdel Latif al-Rashid and Prime Minister designate Mohammed al-Sudani. But I think this is too early to tell. They're not that big in numbers. And I think regardless of who would have been elected, these protests would have been seen.
For you, someone who really pays close attention to Iraq, are you encouraged by this new president and this prime minister designate?
It's difficult to be encouraged because I was encouraged by the last president and prime minister. And so I'm a lot more cautious this time around, regardless of their political affiliations, relations with other countries. Democratization is a long process. Yes, it's been almost 20 years since the 2003 invasion. But that is a small time to rebuild and build new institutions, democratic institutions. And so to see Iraq be able to have six elections, continue to have transfer of power, that's important to see, especially because we started to take that for granted. Saw a lot of violence as government formation. It took over a year to get to this point. And it's a relief for many Iraqis that they were able to avoid violence reaching civil war.
Hamza Haddad is a visiting fellow with the European Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The World. Every 5 years, China's Communist Party elects its next batch of leaders. The process is something of a mystery.
It's very opaque. It's difficult to discern what is happening behind the scenes and what is happening, shall we say, in front of the curtain.
What is clear, Xi Jinping will remain at the top. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Earlier this week, we reported on how the Baltic country of Latvia is trying to keep Russians out, even Russians fleeing conscription. But around 500,000 ethnic Russians already call Latvia home. It's a community that's been there since Soviet times. They've long lived at peace there, if somewhat separately, especially when it comes to language. With the war in Ukraine, though, some ethnic Russians now worry their identity is under threat. Jerry Haddon reports from the Latvian capital, Riga.
In August, as Russian forces advanced into Ukraine, Latvia pushed back, symbolically, by toppling a 259-foot-tall cement and steel obelisk. With the push of a crane, this Soviet-era monument to the Red Army's victory over the Nazis came crashing down. Many Latvians had long been uncomfortable with the obelisk, for them a symbol of Soviet rule over this country. Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine last February turned discomfort into something stronger.
We are fighting right now by demolishing monuments against Putin's idea of Soviet Union number two.
This is historian Valdis Kuzmins from Latvia's National Defense Academy.
He wants Soviet Union back, he said himself many times.
Latvia, as a member of NATO, opposes Putin's expansionist war, but the country has been dismantling Russian symbols since long before Putin came to power, from street signs to statues. The obelisk, though, that struck many of Latvia's ethnic Russians as too much. These days, cranes are still clearing rubble from the monument site. The sound of it bothers Alasia Dudrova, an ethnic Russian doctor here. She's waiting for a bus just across the street.
They think that this monument was the symbol of some kind of oppression from the Russian people, but it was just a symbol that all the world won the Second War. I'm Russian, but I lived here all my life. And I know a Latvian language, and I have Latvian friends, but what Latvian politics did here, it's very stupid, from my opinion.
Dudrova says the mood in Latvia has changed since Russia invaded Ukraine. For the first time in her life, she says, she thinks twice about speaking Russian in certain public places. Ethnic Russians in Latvia say they feel pigeonholed as Putinists, and that's not fair. They're an increasingly diverse group politically, they say, with seven distinct political parties, from pro-Kremlin to progressive. In April, a group of Russian speakers held a protest against Putin's invasion, but many stayed away. The divisions within Latvia's Russian community run along generational lines. The older folks tend to remember the Soviet Union fondly. Also, the closer you get to Latvia's border with Russia, the more pro-Kremlin people are, says newspaper editor Laima Linuja. Her local paper is published in Latvian and Russian in the eastern town of Ludza. Editors took an early stance against the Ukraine invasion. Linuja says the attacks on social media began immediately.
You know, Israel sitka viltus profila.
Someone created a fake Facebook account, she says. They wrote to us saying somebody was going to come to our office and cut off the editor-in-chief's head. Days later, a giant red letter Z, a symbol of the Russian army, was glued to the newspaper's office window. But Linuja says these days, as the war turns in Ukraine's favor, pro-Putin voices have gone quiet. Indeed, finding ethnic Russians willing to talk with a reporter is tough. I don't want to comment on politics, one ethnic Russian man tells me as he rakes leaves along a street only 4 miles from the Russian border. He doesn't want to give his name. But as the war rages on and tensions between the West and Russia rise, Latvia is pushing even harder to erase any vestige of Soviet culture. Conservative politicians here have long had their sights on what they see as the source, Russian language public schools. They've been around since Soviet times. Critics say the schools perpetuate a dual society. Russian educators teach kids that Russia is great, they say, and the West, not so much. This astounds Irina Romanova. She's principal at Russian School number 22 in downtown Riga. We strive to teach our kids how to debate, to be critical thinkers, she says, and to be cultured. These are universal values. But the days of Russian schooling here are numbered. Romanova says they're no longer allowed to use Russian textbooks in class. Just about everything is now taught in Latvian. Romanova says she gets that Latvians want to protect their national language, but she says it weighs on her heart. And besides, she says, Russian families will always speak Russian at home. It's not like they're going to go away. Just then, our chat is interrupted. A little Russian boy comes in, looking upset. Principal, he says, that rascal Igor is running around punching everyone, and we can't get him to stop. The boy is speaking in Russian. Romanova shoots me a look, as if to say, point made. Then she leaves to deal with Igor. For The World, I'm Cherry Haddon, Riga, Latvia.
Today, two activists in the UK poured what appeared to be two cans of tomato soup on a Vincent van Gogh painting. Video shared by the activist group Just Stop Oil shows them then gluing their hands to a wall at the National Gallery in London. One of them, Phoebe Plummer, then launches into a monologue.
Are you more concerned about the protection of a painting or the protection of our planet and people?
The still life of sunflowers, worth an estimated $81 million, was behind glass and wasn't damaged, according to the museum. Eben Lazarus is a spokesperson for Just Stop Oil, the group behind the incident. Eben, what was the goal of the stunt?
I mean, what Just Stop Oil are doing is demanding that the UK government halts all new oil and gas licenses and consents for them. So what the aim of this was to try and bring that to the forefront and to try and break through the media silence on the climate crisis.
So it obviously made headlines. You go after a Van Gogh painting. But what's the evidence that this tactic works beyond just getting you into the news?
I mean, you look at the suffragettes who slashed the rugby Venus, also now rehung in the National Gallery. And we have to do whatever it nonviolently takes to make this social change come about at the speed and scale required, and history repeatedly shows that direct action creating disruption works. That's what history shows.
Because it seems to me a lot of people are just going to remember a Van Gogh painting had tomato soup thrown at it. I mean, do you think people will remember this was Just Stop Oil and what the message is?
I mean, it means that the climate crisis gets into the headlines for a day that it otherwise wouldn't. It means people are talking about the issue, whether they agree or disagree with the action.
Just Stop Oil isn't the only group doing this. Recently, environmental activists have smeared cake on the Mona Lisa and glued themselves to a Botticelli. Why has art become a target of protest for climate activists?
It gets the attention of the media, doesn't it? And it also gets the attention of the general public without actually causing any disruption to them. And in this case, no damage to the artwork either. It's something that can break through this silence that everyone seems to have on the climate crisis and actually get people talking about the issue.
It's interesting, though, by targeting art, it raises a question. I mean, artists and their work have famously been targeted by movements and governments like the Nazis and more recently the Chinese government. Are you concerned it may send the wrong message to target art?
Van Gogh was an impoverished artist who struggled to make ends meet. And that's what's happening now in the UK. Many families, due to the cost of living crisis, going to struggle to make ends meet, going to struggle to survive. They are becoming impoverished by this addiction to oil. The global south is suffering hugely. You know, we have to do whatever it takes. And as much as myself included love art, I don't love it more than life itself.
You know, it's interesting because this latest stunt going after the Van Gogh painting, I mean, it gets people talking about climate change. But, you know, I could argue that people are talking about climate change every day and certainly in the news every day. But what are the policy angles you're also working on besides stunts?
So I think that the difficulty is people aren't talking about climate change, but they're not emotionally connecting with what that means for them, for their future, and what it means right now for communities all across the world. What climate change and the climate crisis means are food shortages, wildfires, droughts, hurricanes, heat waves, and this will lead to the breakdown of our civil society as we know it. What we're asking is completely in line with what the International Energy Agency, the IPCC, are all saying, and that's that from last year, we cannot have any new investment in fossil fuels. So we are asking the government to adhere to their own policies and also to the international guidance that's being given, which is no new fossil fuels.
But why is going after a Van Gogh painting something that would motivate the government to do what you want them to do?
What we have to do is generate the political will and create a political crisis where the politicians are forced to make the change necessary. And it's not by any means the only thing we do targeting art, but it is one of them. And we're trying everything we nonviolently can to create this change because we have to. We have everything to gain and nothing to lose.
We've been speaking to Eben Lazarus. He's a spokesperson for the group Just Stop Oil. Two members of Just Stop Oil poured tomato soup on a painting by the famed post-impressionist artist Vincent van Gogh. Thank you very much, Eben.
Thank you so much, Carol. Cheers.
Here in the U.S., autumn means apple cider and pumpkin pie. In southern Kyrgyzstan, it means walnuts. Kyrgyzstan is home to the largest natural walnut forest on Earth. It's slightly bigger than the state of Pennsylvania. But the forest is coming under intense pressure from climate change and cattle ranching. As Levi Bridges reports from southern Kyrgyzstan, an environmental organization there is now banking on technology to help save the walnuts.
There are two ways to harvest a walnut. Wait until a big storm blows the walnuts down to the ground. Or there's the way 44-year-old Bahadir Fasilov does it. Fasilov's shoes scrape against the bark as he climbs the tree with his arms and legs wrapped tightly around the trunk.
He's about 40 feet up at the top of this tree on this small little branch. I feel a little nervous just watching him.
He shakes the limbs and the nuts come crashing down. Back on the ground, Vasilov brushes away big dry walnut leaves with a stick. Then he collects the nuts and dumps them into a metal pail. This walnut forest is government land. Vasilov rents 10 acres here each year for about $80. He camps out in a tent with his wife and four children for up to 2 months harvesting walnuts. He says they can earn around $1,200. In years past, Vasilov says he picked a ton of nuts here each fall, a literal ton. But this year, he'll be lucky if he picks half that. Climate change is one of the reasons. Vasilov says it got so hot this summer that lots of the nuts fell off early, but there's an even bigger threat facing the trees. The calls from cows are one of the only sounds in this shadowy, ancient walnut forest. Many Kyrgyz make a living herding livestock, like cows and sheep, that graze pastures in the nearby mountains that rise above the walnut trees. Most of those pastures also belong to the government, but the authorities don't put many limits on livestock grazing. And the problem is, there are so many cows, the pastures are getting depleted. So herders let animals roam the walnut forests. Cows here eat the little walnut saplings, which means there's no new growth. And Fasilov shows me where horses are eating bark off the old trees.
Вот, смотри, вот это много кушало здесь. На дереве это травма будет, да?
I drive up a rocky dirt road with Nurgazi Nurbayev, a manager at the local environmental organization Camp Elato. We're headed to pasture land, high above the walnut forest. We step out of the car onto a hillside that's covered in black dirt. This hill is naked. The animals ate everything, Nurbayev says. He tells me there's 2.5 times more animals grazing here than the pasture can support. Nurbayev leads me across this dusty hillside to big metal cages secured with padlocks. Inside, there's grass and shrubs growing. This is what the pasture would look like if there were no animals, Nurbayev says. Camp Elato's researchers collect data in these cages to gauge how much grazing the land can actually support. But Camp Elato's project manager, Drugal Khorjanberdiev, says not enough herders are following their recommendations.
Many people are just continuing as business as usual.
Khorjanberdiev hopes that technology can be part of the solution. He helped develop a new smartphone app that herders can use to document the changing environment. And it's pretty simple.
So you have to take a photo of that pasture.
Okay.
Then you select from checklists what kind of plants grow there, what the soil's like, and then tag your location.
And so you have to put the name of the region, village name.
So it's almost kind of like making an Instagram post, but you're just adding extremely detailed scientific information about what you see.
Yes, exactly.
The information gets uploaded to a server that scientists can access. Korjan Berdiyev says there hasn't been much research done about Kyrgyzstan's pasture lands since the end of the Soviet Union. So herders, even though they've exacerbated the environmental problems, can be part of the solution. Beside a rushing river below the walnut forests, one of Korjan Berdiyev's colleagues shows me a new bridge Camp Alato built, so locals can lead their herds to new pastures.
Ледники растаивают там, солнце весной так жарко было.
But he says last spring, melting glaciers up in the mountains made the river rise as high as the bridge. The challenges facing the environment here, where locals have few economic opportunities besides raising cattle, are immense. But the bridge is a testament to the commitment these environmental workers have made to save an ecosystem that supports the nearby walnut forests. Just because it's getting harder doesn't mean they're giving up. For The World, I'm Levi Bridges at the edge of the bizarre Korgon walnut forest, southern Kyrgyzstan.
In Beijing, red banners on public display declare, "Unite around Comrade Xi Jinping." Xi is about to lead the Communist Party Congress, which happens once every 5 years, and it kicks off on Sunday. More than 2,000 members of China's Communist Party will gather to begin installing a new lineup of top officials. Xi will almost certainly retain his position as supreme leader. But as The World's Patrick Nguyen reports, that's because he's been busy eliminating any potential rivals.
One of the biggest events in geopolitics this weekend might be a bit uneventful. No one's expecting surprises. But make no mistake, Xi Jinping has worked very hard to make sure of that. Those are Communist Party elites welcoming their leader into the Great Hall of the People, a lavish chamber big enough to hold a blimp. That was last year when China's lawmakers, the Party Congress, met to hash out their next five-year plan. This Sunday, they'll enact that plan and anoint the next wave of leaders.
The party coalesces around the top 300 leaders in the country, creating essentially the pinnacle pyramid of the party.
Drew Thompson is with the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy in Singapore. He's a former China analyst with the U.S. Defense Department. Thompson says even inside the U.S. government, no one is entirely sure how the party selects its leaders, the core group running the world's number two superpower.
It's very opaque. It's difficult to discern what is happening behind the scenes and what is happening, shall we say, in front of the curtain.
What's clear is that any internal jockeying is not about ideas. There is no evidence of factions trying to pull China in a different ideological direction. So any infighting would concern rank and power. But analysts say there's not much of that either. Not anymore. And this is no accident. Just listen to Xi himself. Since our last Congress meeting, we've been fighting tigers and flies. Xi said this at a mass gathering in 2016, standing before a giant red curtain. By tigers and flies, he means corrupt officials, large and small. Xi says the biggest threat to the party isn't the U.S. or an economic meltdown, it's corrupt party members. But Drew Thompson says in China, corruption has a special meaning.
Oftentimes, there is a conflation between corruption and loyalty.
Loyalty to the party, loyalty to Xi. Xi has spoken of cabals and cliques who've lost faith in socialism and instead try to enrich themselves. He's led a crusade to hunt them down, though critics say he focuses on potential rivals and overlooks transgressions by his own loyalist. Either way, this is not a quiet purge. There's even a TV drama about it.
You said the house isn't yours.
A clip from In the Name of the People, starring an anti-corruption investigator who finds party members in bed with blonde mistresses and with cash bribes stashed in their refrigerators. Getting labeled corrupt in China is no joke. 3 weeks ago, the former vice minister of public security, accused of racking up $90 million in bribes, was sentenced to death. This crusade is ongoing. and the upcoming Party Congress is, in part, a celebration of its success. Thompson calls it a victory lap, but the party, he says, is not complacent.
They're very cognizant of risks that must be managed. And that's partly why you have such extensive national surveillance systems, why you have such a large police force.
Stamping out disloyalty, he says, is a never-ending struggle. China says its Communist Party is the most stable ruling party ever. Sounds like propaganda, but it's probably true. And this is not a one-man operation. Those at the very top comprise a seven-person unit called the Politburo Standing Committee. This is Xi's brain trust. And yes, he does have to listen to them.
Xi Jinping, in a way, answers to a board of directors the way a CEO would in a company. So rather than simply being a dictator, he is the leader of a group.
For now, this all-male board of directors is squarely behind their paramount leader. But Xi's concentration of power does bring a risk that the party hates to talk about. He is 69, and there's no clear successor in sight. No one knows who would replace him. Well, no one on this side of the Red Curtain. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
Yesterday, we reported on a protest on the eve of China's Party Congress. A protest banner unfurled over a Beijing bridge, and an amplified voice spoke to drivers as they slowed down to watch smoke billowing from burning tires. The government reaction was quick, says The Economist's David Rennie.
Right now, the city is locked down like a drum.
And online, something similar happened. Government censors blocked Chinese people from searching for the word Beijing online. Same for the name of the highway overpass where the protest banner was hung, the Sitong Bridge. So activists online have found a way around the censors, at least momentarily. Take this song called Sitong Bridge. It's by the group Mr. Graceless, and its lyrics are benign. It's a love song. But in the comment section on a Chinese music streaming site, someone's posted the words that were written on those Beijing protest banners. We want to eat, not do coronavirus tests. Reform, not the Cultural Revolution. We want freedom, not lockdowns. Elections, not rulers. This song, among several others, was eventually blocked by the Chinese streaming service QQ Music. Here's another example of online protest. The man who staged the bridge protest was being called a lonely warrior online until those words were also blocked. And a Chinese news Twitter account posted a music video of this song, Lonely Brave, as an honor. The lyrics go, I love you walking alone. I love the way you don't kneel. Battle and war with the humblest dream. We'll play some of it for you here. Cover version of the song The Lonely Brave, the theme from a popular Chinese television series. It was posted online today in honor of the Beijing protester Peng Lifa. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. We'll see you back here on Monday.